Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I've had quite a few people react to David Williams' show, him being the Prime Minister and talking about self-determination. And I had people contact me and say I should talk to Ken Cousins. And they, too, are setting up a new society and a bank, and they have instituted their self-determination rights. And what I'm noticing is that more and more people are trying to set up a new society, separate themselves from the United States, and trying to make things better and change. So I was contacted by Ken Cousins and his team to talk to them about what they're doing on that front. And I'm really interested in that because there's more and more activity around that. He has about 900 members that are working with him to do this. Again, it's a paradigm shift. It talks about history being different. But how do you go about setting up a new society? And what does that mean? We're going to get into more of that. We'll get into more of that with David Williams as well. But just kind of entertaining these ideas. From what I understand behind the scenes, I'm hearing that a lot of prominent business people and prominent people in the United States are looking into this stuff. How do we reset up the United States in a way that is better for the citizens, get us out of this major debt issue we have, and keep the corruption at bay? And so I'll be doing more of this, more of a series with different people who are looking at these issues and how to do this, because we have to do something. We can't go on forever being in major debt, doing horrible, corrupt type activities, and then not having control of our destiny. So I'd like to see what other people are doing on that front. Obviously, it goes with our theme of business game changers because they're trying to change the big game on how things work. So let's get into my interview now with Ken Cousins. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the program.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm great. And thank you very much for joining us today. I have a lot of questions for you. You have a very interesting thing that you have going, and I think a lot of people want to hear about it and understand it, which I know is going to take some time. And you've said that it's going to take at least a year, and I know that it is because it's such a paradigm shift. But maybe you can answer some questions and we can get through some of that. You've created a new society. Why have you done this?
Well, because, first of all, I have always been a student of many things in this world. About 27 years ago, I began my studies in law, which led to expanding my already fairly involved studies of history. I spent a lot of time in my early years studying roots of religion and many things about history and things like that. And when you start studying law, you have to study and understand history. If you don't, then you're going to be confined to what appears to be the reality that we're told exists is how law works or how the world system works. Ultimately, law and history underwrite one key topic, everybody's favorite topic, which is money. Law and money are the flip side of the same coin, which we'll get into as we proceed in our conversation.
Well, so now, how does your society differ from that of the United States?
Okay, well, we didn't finish the first question.
Oh, well, keep going. I don't want to cut you off.
That's fine. But you did raise a point that I was going to get to. So, long story made short, I've spent the last 27 years in a full immersion in these primary topics, law, history, and money. Essentially, the world system. How has it been put together? How does it currently operate? It currently exists as a system of dominance and bondage, aka control, control of life, control of creativity, and control of the human population, and really all of living beings and so forth. And you have to expand that understanding in order to get past that containment field, as I will call it, we'll talk about later. So as to the subject of society, in studying law and history, ultimately come to the understanding that all entities that call themselves sovereign bodies, so you just reference the United States as a society, and that is true. The Vatican is a society, or the Roman Catholic Church. The Jesuits are a society. The royal crowns basically are societies. So the fundamental building block of working institutions that we call body politics is what a society is. And then this goes back in English law about 500 to 600 years ago. And as things started emerging in the 14 and 1500s and into the 1600s in the city of London, where all English law and essentially all banking is controlled and the world system is controlled in one key component, societies began to be built and they were created. And they were essentially fraternities, brotherhoods, guilds, churches, what we would call unions, and they still essentially direct and control the city of London, which is the center of banking. It's the center of the world legal system. It's where the bar sits, the bar associations that control the legal systems in the world. And if you study that and you look at that, the societies are called liveries. And the ones that control the city of London are like the fishmongers, and the leather workers and things like that. Very fundamental. You think very basic. Oh, these are the guys that control the world. Of course, that's not what they're really doing. They're not selling fish on the streets of London or the city of London. But that was the basis of creating the body of law out of the city of London that we call English law. And the society was a fundamental building block. And, you know, I could go further into that subject, but that's the bottom line. So in my studies, starting in the late 90s, I started being introduced to this point. And by the early 2000s, I came to understand that by forming a private society, a society has, just like any country, what we would call a nation or a country, a private society or a public society, but I choose private, which we will discuss as well, has the capacity and the inherent authority to create its own law form, to create its own jurisdiction, to essentially create its own body politic. It can create its own private monetary, aka money type system. It can have its own private treasury, aka a bank or a banking structure. And it can be an educational institution. It can be a political institution. It can be many things. So this is the reason why we have built everything as a private society.
Now, as a private society, does it have to operate under international law? Is that how it works? Or, I mean, what laws does it have to follow in the context of the world?
Okay. Well, anytime one society interacts with another, there's what's called comity, which is a co-relationship in terms of jurisdiction or law form. So if we, let's just say starting with the United States, in the last 5 years, and we started this in the early 2000s, but my understanding of what we had in terms of what we could do, the capacity to build this society really started emerging and maturing about 5 years ago. At that time, we took what my knowledge of law and the legal system in terms of the judicial system, the administrative non-judicial processes, what many, many people do, commerce in the public, things like that. And I sort of morphed it or transformed it into, because in law, everything is on the basis of notice and fulfillment of that notice, either by response or by default acquiescence to what that notice said, and the responding party does not respond, and so essentially it stands unrebutted or in default. So I used that understanding, and I started for the Pantera d'Oro Society noticing, all the major world administrative and sovereign bodies. That included the Vatican, the Holy See, the Lord Mayor of the City of London, of course, all of the international bodies, the UN, the World Court at The Hague, and then national and state bodies, the Secretary of State, the President, and so forth of the United States. And then we're in California, so several of the office holders in California. And none of them responded, except for one, actually. The UN, we sent it to Ban Ki-moon, who was the Secretary General of the UN at the time. And somebody in his office wrote back, essentially said, in effect, well, we can't respond per se, but we wish you good luck in your endeavor. So in a sense, it was a tacit cognizance of what we were doing. But by not responding, and everybody else, there was about 26 respondents, when they don't respond, then it stands as fact. It's unrebutted. Then you do something what's called an adjudicated legal notice, which is legal notice papers, all of which are registered with local courts in the county. And if you run a legal notice of an adjudicated or a defaulted administrative process, and you say, we did this, this, and this, we are this society, and this, that, the other, and you run it for 4 weeks, and that is essentially a what's called in legal terms res judicata, or an adjudicated finality that will stand. So we did that 5 years ago. A year later, I sent a six-page letter to the nuncio, which is the head of, I forget how it's pronounced, but the nunciature, which is essentially the embassy of the Vatican to Washington, D.C., representing the Holy See. And the Holy See holds what's called the Roman Curia, which means Roman court. And this is the highest court in the world. All other courts come under the Roman Curia. And you may be familiar, perhaps not. Are you aware of something called an apostolic letter that was issued by Pope Francis in July of 2011?
No. Please inform us on what that is.
Okay. Of course, the position of the Pope is based on something called apostolic succession. Peter, through all the popes to this day, it's an office. It's a perpetual, eternal office to which all of the assets or all of the value that accrues, tangible and intangible, is retained by that office. So the Pope holds that office, just like a monarch holds the office of the crown, or just like the president holds the office of the presidency. That gives continuity and perpetuity to those offices and what's created within them. So the Pope has essentially within its system superior or supreme authority. And when the Pope issues an apostolic letter called a motu proprio, which is my own hand or my own voice, that is essentially in the world system the highest decree or law in the entire world. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what he issued in that on July 11th was essentially that there are economic terrorists that exist in this world, and any institution or member of an institution under the authority of the Roman Curia, remember the Curia is the highest world court, essentially is beholden to any economic or political terrorism enacted through that political position or institution. So I based what we've done in the last 5-6 years on that as well. And a lot of what we do when we communicate with offices of the United States or subdivision, corporate subdivisions, we reference that. Essentially, we are holding office holders to the task to be lawful within the bounds of their legal codes and statutes and constraints. We'll get into what that means in a minute. But getting back to the letter that I sent to the Holy See, the nuncio, it was essentially an offer of treaty, a treaty of peace and a cessation of hostilities. And this gets into some of your further questions as to what is status correction? Why do we correct our status? What is it that we have as an ultimate solution to get out of the bondage of the matrix and basically the control system of that legal and monetary and banking system that limits and curtails our creative capacity to truly heal and transform our lives, our communities, our nations, and this world, which is our mission statement and purpose of our society.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure, but
want to ask you a question on when they acknowledge your existence. You know, when is that going to happen, and did that already happen? And
sure, yeah.
You know, what you think of that. Go ahead.
Okay, well, that's actually where I was going to go with this. So, so the point relative to that offer of treaty of peace and cessation of hostilities is because everybody wants to know the door, what's the exit out of the matrix. We all know there is a matrix. We all know that we are bound and bonded and in a system of perpetual indebtedness out of which we want to get. We don't know how to get to that door. We don't know where that door is. The secret to that solution is to remove oneself from the field of battle, because everything in the legal and monetary system is as we currently have it, the money, Federal Reserve notes, pesos, pounds, euros, etc., they're all structured as monetized debt. And the way the legal system and the monetary system is structured, developed over literally thousands of years and perfected over the last 100 years, is that we are bonded to that debt. And a bond is both evidence of a trust relation as well as a evidence of a debt. So corporations issue what? Stocks and bonds. Well, the bonds are debt. United States issues bonds. Those are debt. Those bonds of the United States and every national corporation, because they're all corporations, are what underwrites and collateralize this system of monetized debt. So we are what's called a surety. A surety guarantees or assures some sort of obligation. So the definition of our status is we are a bonded surety to a bankrupt franchise. And we'll get into that later. But to get back to your question of the response and so forth, the acknowledgement or the cognizance, is when we sent that that offer of treaty and it was not responded to, and when we sent the notices, as I described earlier, to the world administrative offices and they were not responded to, and we did an adjudicated notice and it was not rebutted, this stands in law and in their system, in commerce and in other jurisdictional aspects of the law, which, yes, is very complex, but that's what we teach people, how to understand it in relatively clear and concise terms, because law is multifaceted, multi-layered, and one aspect which we're talking about is administrative notice and response or acquiescence and default and adjudication.
Now,
so when they do not respond,
go ahead.
Excuse me, when they don't respond, and then you perfect that lack of response, it stands. It is unrebutted. And we've also incorporated the body of ecclesiastical law, which many people confuse to think, well, that means you're a church or you're a religion or, you know, a denomination or so forth. And we use the law form to our benefit. Ecclesiastical law is the highest law on this planet. Okay. But the core or root of that word is the word ecclesia, which is a Greek word, and it simply means the body of the congregation. So when people come together, they create a congregation. Does not have to be religious, does not have to be denominational, doesn't even have to be hierarchical. That's the old system. But it cannot be refuted or rebutted that we are a body, a collective body, as an ecclesiastical body politic. And these are part of the content of these notices and so forth that I've shared. And in their law form, it cannot be overturned. And we've proven that by actual functional events over and over for the last 5 years, including the fact that when we tell the IRS or the Department of Justice or federal courts or state courts or other administrative bodies, the only way you can communicate to us is as this court of the ecclesia of the Pantera d'Oro private society and ecclesiastical body politic, and they do that. We have
okay, so that's your acknowledgement. It's the fact that they follow the procedures of you being a society, a private society. Okay, that's what I was looking for. Some kind of,
Yeah, I understand. Exactly. Most people think in terms of, well, did you get a letter from the IRS saying, yes, we recognize you as such? No, we didn't, because I don't, as a superior authority, I don't need an inferior body, a fictional corporation in commerce, to acknowledge or approve me. Most people go to the IRS, they get a 501c3 designation, or they get other types of response letters that say, yes, you are such, such, such. And if you do that, then you're in their jurisdiction. Okay. Then you're bound and beholden to all their jurisdictional codes, statutes, and everything else.
But are you ever worried that our federal government ignores it and just wipes you out? You know what I mean? Or can they not?
Well, if they did that, they would be, and of course, many people will say, yeah, but they have all the guns and the heavy boots and they'll just run you over. But what I was going to say is, if they did that, they would be effectively denying everything that they've built their entire world system on. Secondly, when I say we sent a letter, a treaty of peace and cessation of hostilities, what that means in factual terms or functional terms is everything that almost everybody does is in commerce. Commerce, by definition, means a bonded relationship of a debtor and a creditor. So when I say we're a bonded surety to a bankrupt franchise, first of all, that means for us who are in North America, in the United States was transmigrated from what we think of as the republic or a union, all those things from the 1770s and onward, but it was migrated into a corporation during the history from the 1780s onward. That corporation was relatively at all levels since 1789, was always a bankrupt in international bankruptcy law. By 1781, they shifted into a different type of corporation, and in March of 1933, that corporation was put into full bankruptcy. All members of the United Nations are bankrupt corporations. Okay, in order to be a member, they had to pledge their central bank to the IMF and the World Bank, and underlying the central banks is all the bonding of the entire population. Okay. There's a lot of detail, a lot of...
That makes sense to me, though. I mean, theoretically, it all makes sense.
Yeah. And so this is where world bondage in a commercial monetary sense began. Washington, D.C. is at the apex of a pyramid of commercial bondage through monetized debt throughout the entire world.
So now you, with your society, you are no longer part of that. So how you differ from the United States is you and everybody who's part of that society who's perfected their status, which we have to get back to, are not part of that debt system anymore. How does that, and correct me if that's wrong, how does that materially change for you? What practical things changes for you being part of that?
Very good question. First, let me say that we are in transition. Okay. This is not a Hollywood movie where the heroes go from being chased by the bad guys and suddenly in the last 15 minutes everything transforms and they walk into the sunrise and they're not in debt and all those good things. We are building a prototype model. And as you said earlier, we are creating a paradigm shift. many people in this world are part of that. You yourself obviously are, and the people that you've been interviewing, and many people in the emerging alternative media, people who are dealing with the law system and many other things. We are shifting the paradigm in this world, and it's transitional. You know, you are a visionary. You see where you want to go with what you've been building with your media, correct?
I try to be, yes. Okay. I think it's working, but...
Yeah, but you're in transition. You're not quite where you want to be necessarily. You know what you have in terms of your internal capacity and potential, but there are several things limiting that. A big part of that is the financial, of course. Mm-hmm. Others are technical and legal and otherwise, but you can see the potential that you're bringing forward. I have been the same, and many people who have helped build Pantera and the society have come together because we see what we're moving towards to build. So it's not that we don't interact with the debt system or the money system. There's a key point when we get into the discussion of status correction of what you do need to do, but we have to still be in the world, essentially in it, but not of it.
Yeah, and so what I want to get to is something that somebody can hold on to so they can understand a specific difference. Like, how does it affect them in a tangible way? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's go back a few steps to what I was saying about building up the understanding that the United States and all nations that we think of as sovereign countries are really bankrupt corporations, okay? They've monetized their currency, and it's all pegged, has been up until just really now, but it is shifting as we speak. But since the 1940s was pegged to the U.S. dollar, which is really the Federal Reserve note. They all had to hold Federal Reserve notes to buy oil and also as a reserve currency. That was set up post-World War II when the UN and the World Bank and the IMF were created in 44 and 45. All those nations came together and created something called the Bretton Woods Agreement, which linked and locked all currencies at a fixed exchange rate to the Federal Reserve note. And at that time, the Fed note was backed by gold. Of course, that was released in 71. And it was transformed again to a petrodollar. So everything was controlled by the dollar and the consumption of energy. And as the expansion of energy consumption proceeded, that enabled them to expand the Fed note as the world reserve and active currency. And that gave them global control. It all linked to the fact that Federal Reserve note was and is a commercial instrument controlled by the function of commerce, or as many people who study law are familiar and have heard the term, the Uniform Commercial Code. And the UCC defines a debtor-creditor relationship. Here's the gist, or here's the kicker. When you engage in commerce, technically by the definition of the world system and legal definitions going back thousands of years, you are in a field of battle. You are at war. Okay. That's why it's called the law merchant, and it's called maritime or admiralty maritime law. Well, that's international law, but it's also martial law, the rules of war. Okay. And so when I say we withdraw ourselves from the field of battle, we disconnect from being the personal, the living being, the man, the woman, and so forth, as the bonded surety that is perpetuating and participating with this system of war. War, destruction, environmental destruction, social destruction, everything we see going on this planet today.
So you no longer are an asset that they can use as collateral to do what they're doing.
Correct.
Okay.
And so in practical terms, as many people of conscience and commitment to see this world be transformed, If I were to show you letter and accounting and everything and legal structure, which would that would take us a year, but I can do it, and that's what we do in our society, in our university. Show you how that every time you do everything from buying, taking a $10 bill out of your pocket and buying milk and bread for your children, or having a utility bill, or paying your tax, or doing everything we take for granted every single day, that you are actively engaging in war and participating in a field of battle that has become global in scope and is literally destroying life on this planet, life as we see it being literally collapsing at this time.
And what you're doing when you're involved, but when you buy bread and you buy stuff, aren't you, other than not being an asset anymore that is collateral, but by participating, you're still, you have to, you're still get fueling things because you have to.
Right. Okay. That gets back to understanding that we're in transition. Okay. One of the concepts that I understood about 20 years ago, and I coined a phrase called the transfer mechanism and the receptacle, because I understood all of this in essence and in a fair amount of detail in the 1990s. I didn't know it nearly as much as I do now, because I've spent the last 20 years truly integrating it and getting the entire crystal clear whole picture. But I had a lot of innate understanding. It was my nature going back 50, 60 years and all the study I've done about this world. And I could see also from my business, my past in the business arena from the 1970s. I was in the gemstone and jewelry business, hard assets, precious metals, things like that. And I watched things that I didn't understand. I had to deal with in the 70s and 80s, you know, interest rates going up, assets going up, going down, money up and down, all the stuff that we went through in the 80s, 70s and 80s. By the time I started studying law, and as I said, to study and understand law, you have to understand history. If you understand history and law, you absolutely have to understand money and banking. So by the mid to late 90s, I started understanding quite clearly everything we've talked about now and the fact that the monetary system is a containment field. It holds our consciousness, our capacity to create, and we are literally containing our own, creating our own prison. Okay, we are the creators. The world elite and the bankers and those in the esoteric systems behind them understand this very well. They are trained to understand how to contain the world population through the world system and utilize them through media and mind control and programming to entrain the individual and the collective mind to project into this containment field and create this system we're talking about, which is perpetual enslavement. And so I understood that we had to transfer our consciousness and the energy value that we have created, that we've allowed to be bonded in that containment field. But if we didn't have a truly self-contained receptacle to hold it and redirect our creative capacity into creating a reality and a world that we choose, that we say is our purpose and intention, that this world will work for every human, every living being, every ecosystem, every ocean and river and all those things. That's the world that I set out to create. That's the world that my full will and purpose and intent in that of our society has been established on. I'm sure that's essentially ringing true for you and many people who are watching this. So we have to have a receptacle to shift, transfer our energy, our consciousness, and our creative capacity into a system or a receptacle that is not owned and controlled, that will come back like a stretched rubber band, that we think we're free and we're running out of the prison, but we've got this stretching rubber band that will only let us get so far, and then it goes voom and pulls us back in. We have to sever those jurisdictional and contractual attachments, and we have to start recreating the value and the principles and the wealth in a receptacle that is properly structured so that we are not being controlled by the matrix.
Okay, so I want to get into more of how that's properly structured, but before we get into that, can you explain, you often talk about how our history is different than what we've been taught, okay?
Correct.
Why are we being taught something different than really what happened? And why would a false narrative need to be given? Who does this help? And, you know, and after you tell us that, then I would like you to go into a little bit more of what the true history is.
Okay, very good. Well, I already answered the second question of why. Okay.
That's so the elites.
Yeah, well, but I'm going to elaborate.
Thank you.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to digress a minute and say that my personal history in this life has been very deeply immersed in the esoteric. Studying roots of religion, but also all of the, you know, not the standard religion, but the metaphysical, the multidimensional, and the esoteric, symbology, numerology, astrology, all those systems that we could encapsulate and call esoterica or the esoteric systems. When you really understand that, and you also understand everything we've talked about, the legal, historical, and monetary system and structure, you can see that they're the flip sides of the same coin. Okay, all of these elite bodies, and you also in your document you sent with your questions asked about, essentially you were asking, well, we're a society. Does that mean we're a secret society? Or why are we different than, we talked about political societies. But we also know that there's so-called esoteric or secret societies, the Freemasons and, you know, the Illuminati and many, all these names that we know. Those systems and those bodies are built on principles of a layered or hierarchical system. Okay. We speak of the word esoteric, but there's also a word mesoteric and there's also a word exoteric. Exo is the exterior, the public face, so that the Masons or other bodies, even the monarchies and so forth, they all have, and, you know, the Rockefellers and so forth, they all have public exoteric exterior faces that look social, they look environmentally concerned, they're involved in medical, you know, the Rockefellers control the American Cancer Society, that all looks very nice and publicly digestible. The so-called esoteric societies are built in the same way, so that the exterior has a certain visible persona. It's at the bottom of the pyramid or the hierarchy. And as you prove your capacity and your alignment with the more interior or esoteric purposes and intentions, you are matriculated or you're graduated up. You know, we hear 33 degrees in masonry and things like that. The political systems are structured in the exact same way. The IRS is structured exactly as the Masonic system with degrees of elevation. The judicial system the same way. And so it's been said many times in the alternative media, you know, innumerable times that to qualify in the old world system for higher positions, political office or higher executive office in a corporation, essentially the higher you go, the more sociopathic and psychopathic you have to be. Okay, and that's an absolute, for me, an absolute truth. Because look at these mindless entities run by men and women who have absolutely no empathy to humans or life or whatever. Look at Monsanto, you know. Mm-hmm. It promotes its agenda as if it's valid and real, but we know it's absolutely destroying the food and the soil and the animals and the bees and so forth in this entire global ecosystem. You have to be a sociopath to do that and look at that as what's the bottom line. Okay,
well, so, 1 out of 21 people are clinically diagnosed as psychopaths.
Right,
so they're all walking around. So maybe they naturally rise to those type of positions.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. Well, there's a psychiatrist. I don't know if he's still alive. I think he is called Scott Peck. He wrote a book called The Path Less Traveled, but he also wrote a book called The People of the Lie. And if you read it, it's a very short, simple book to read. He took in his psychiatric clinical work for decades, and he studied the nature of psychopathy and sociopathy. And he determined that about 25% of the world, or at least the Western world, the United States population, was essentially sociopathic, you know. And then out of that 25%, you get, you know, less percentage, but those top several percent, like you said, you know, 5%, 3%, they're true psychopaths.
And they mess up everything. They get thrown, they're mingled in, and you don't know where they are, and they're just messing up everybody.
Sure. They only treat life as an object. Okay. And this is all, you can see this in psychology and emotional content as well as the legal and the monetary. This is hardwired in our monetary system. Everything is based on profit and all those kind of things. Ultimately, when you get into the esoteric, to get back to that subject, the world system is a cult of death. It is all based on death. Okay, and I can show you this into the nth degree. So not only is commerce a field of battle, but it is also involved at the esoteric level as a cult of death. It's all based on linguistic, etymological basis in our language on words that ultimately reiterate over and over a death principle.
Can you give an example?
Sure. I'm going to go to work tomorrow. I'm going to wake up and engage or enter the morning and go earn a living. Right? I'm going to wake up, engage the morning, and earn a living. Okay. If my father dies, I go to a wake for him. Okay. And I engage in mourning. And when he's cremated, they put his ashes in an urn.
So it's a cycle back to earning money.
Well, it's just the language is stating something that we think sounds good. Wake up in the morning, earn a living. Okay, it's just an example. Okay,
yeah.
I can show you in the legal definitions and the structure. For one thing, when I say we're a bonded surety to a bankrupt franchise, the franchise is the birth certificate and the all capital letter name or the upper lowercase with a surname attached to it.
Yeah, and that clearly makes sense that we can be assets for the bankrupt organization, which
right.
is the United States. What I don't understand yet is the death society. You know,
okay.
There's some words, but I mean, how does that really, you know?
Let's hold that thought and come back to that because
okay.
we're talking about, you asked the question is one, how are we different than those secret societies? I started talking about the esoteric hierarchical structure and all of that. And the answer to that question you answered, why is this all created? Again, it's the same thing as I was saying, to control, it's mass mind control, to control the minds of who we are in actuality as the true creators of our own reality, our own existence. And if we're entrained and continually re-entrained on virtually a perpetual ongoing nature. At this point, we have electronics. We exist in a wireless system that is entraining us with certain frequencies, watching media, whether we don't watch TV or not, looking at this computer. It has energetic and electronic and frequencies coming out. We are entrained. And then the entertainment, all the sex and violence and everything else, it's constantly programming us to believe that the reality we're in is a valid or a true reality. It appears that way, but in fact, we are creating something that we say we don't want to engage with. So as I was saying, that every time you operate through that franchise and you allow that name to be used to monetize debt and that circulates as currency, then we are engaging in perpetuating that system. We are engaging in war and death and essentially destruction.
We're supporting the culture that does that.
Correct. And that's a very good phrase, the culture, the root of which is cult. So culture is if you take a Petri dish and you put a living organism in it and have the right environment, it will replicate and it will, you know, culture itself, right? Well, think of us as in a giant Petri dish and the environment has been created to culture us into what we have been talking about. So that's why I say it's a cult of death. And this goes back to the history of religion and the esoteric. I've studied a lot going back to Egypt and Sumer, and Babylon, and, you know, in the systems that emerged out of that. That has been a continuum for the last 5,000 years. We still exist in Babylon. We still exist in the Roman Empire. That's why New York is called the Empire State and things of that nature. There's not a break at all in 5,000 years of history of the development and the perfecting of this system to create a cult of death. If you look behind the religions that say they're about life, you will see where the roots of that Christianity is rooted in other things that predated 2,000 years ago that were straight away, you know, based on blood sacrifice. They were based on all the things that are now hidden in plain sight, but now they're coming to the fore, all the pedophilia and all of those kind of things. That has never not existed in this reality. Okay.
Well, can I ask you, the people who are at the very top of these societies, are they very well aware of what's going on? Are they cognitive of it and they trying to perpetuate it, or are they just mindlessly doing it?
Really both. They're definitely, when I talked about the hierarchy and the graduating up the degrees of all these systems, whether it's Masonry or the IRS or the judicial or the political, in order to qualify to rise up in those systems, you have to be aware of it and you have to cognize it and you have to acquiesce or sign to it, because fundamentally, the basis of law is always contract, and contract has fundamentals. You know, meeting of the minds, full disclosure, and reciprocation of consideration. I give you value, you give me something else. You get what you want, I get what I want. So yes,
where does
pedophilia
go into that? Like, the highest levels of those organizations have to condone it and perpetuate it, and the lower levels absolutely detest it. So, you know, is that what's going on? The highest level of those organizations are promoting it, supporting it, involved in it, and consciously supporting it. And, you know, how does that fit into contract law and, you know, do you understand what I'm saying? How does that fit in?
Yeah. Well, let's come back to that and answer what is contract, what is law.
Okay.
Fundamentally, the essential building block of all law is contract. It's an agreement between two or more parties. A society is defined as basically people of like mind, like purpose, like intent, who come together and form a society, and they create a body of law and other things to maintain their purpose and intention. If you and I make an agreement, we create a contract, whether it's verbal or written. So when you study all of this and really analyze and pull all the pieces apart, you see that, to get back to your question, all of these players, many of whom are now being exposed, many of whom are trying to get free of it and are trying to expose, and many of those of whom are being eliminated. I mean,
there's a lot of people being killed. Yes.
You know, bankers falling out of windows, bankers committing suicide with nail guns, three to the chest, you know, or two shots to the back of the head. You know, actors being blown out of cars and many other things. You know, because of course Hollywood and the entertainment and the media is hardwired with the political and the monetary. Actually, if you look at the landed gentry or the aristocracy over millennia or centuries, you see that there was basically four or five main places. They all created family, primarily interested in the sons. The daughters were chattel that they would trade and marry off and so forth.
It's awful, right?
Yeah. But the sons would go into the military, the monetary, the media, the management, which is political. And I know there's a fifth one that I devised to be an M. I forget what that is. But those are the main areas. Oh, the priesthood, of course. I forget what the M was. But military, media, monetary, management, and basically bondage. Because religion, from the Latin, the word religion means ligere, which means to bond or bind. So religion is to bind and bond again. And when you follow the pathway from religion, because they're used to, like thousands of years ago, there was no separation between religion and the priesthood and the kingly class and the elite class and the monetary class. They're all really one and the same. The temples were the banks. The crown or the king controlled all the land. So essentially the two fundamentals that emerged out of those societies and epochs were what I've called the line of the king, which controls the land, and all of the land is essentially where all the wealth comes from, okay? And the line of the priests that controlled the law. And people adhered to the law by fearing God, fearing the priests, and what they said, you have to do this. You had to ritualize yourself to follow the law and not be excommunicated or expelled or exiled from the community. This cellularly programmed the human condition for thousands of years to obey God or the priest, the representative of God in this domain. And essentially, the fundamentals of that relationship were that God, through its priesthood class and its law, binds you and bonds you to that law because you have been given a grant of life, and that created a perpetual debt. And you must pay that debt by being obedient and obeisant to the law and be under the yoke of that law, to stand under it and to be bonded to the authority of the law and the priest class. So that's the root of the evolution leading up to today. We now have priesthoods. We have medical priesthoods. We have legal priesthoods, agricultural priesthoods, et cetera, et cetera. They all have these codified systems that bind and bond us because we have accepted a debt. Because when I say you're a bonded surety to a monetized debt, I mean bonded surety to a bankrupt franchise, that franchise is part of the United States, a corporation in bankruptcy, which is owned or controlled by its creditors, which is the banking system, all the way up to the City of London. Okay, and in international law that controls bankruptcy, a bankrupt has no standing. You don't really have any basis in law. So all of this illusion that we're in a democracy or a republic and we have common law and so forth, all that is gone now. It can be returned to.
But don't you think that at a basic level we have some things that are followed? Like there is a, but once you get higher up, it's all thrown out the window. Or sure. If you interact with something higher up, it's thrown out the window. But at a basic level, there's people interact with the law. Yeah.
I mean, by and large, humans do get along, and we have been socialized to have that kind of honor and respect, except for, again, that part of the population.
The psychopaths.
The psychopaths and the sociopaths. there, you know, there's level and degree there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, we function, you know, billions of people function every day within the system and get along. But I'm talking about at the macro scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the fundamental of what we need to change is the global or the macro scale. But we can't do that. You know, I can't shift this whole macro scale planetary system, but I can transform myself both legally, monetarily, status-wise, all of that. And by so doing, knowing that we're in a holographic reality, that the part is the same blueprint or template as the larger whole, that I am actively transforming the larger whole. And when we come together as a society of like-minded people and work together and help each other and assist each other for that self-transformation, that is transformative on the macro scale. But so, what we're looking at is we have to understand the nature of our reality that we're in. Without, I've heard many, many people say, I don't need any of that stuff. I don't need to worry about law or money because it doesn't affect me, but it does. It affects us tremendously. And we are part of the whole. And what we're moving towards is a unity consciousness rather than a separation consciousness.
Do you think the psychopaths and the sociopaths are a high enough percentage that no matter what we do, they're always going to be mingled in and mess us up? Or do you think we could?
Well, I think we're in a transition, as I said, and in that transition, the quantum whole of what I just described, that by individual transformation, we're moving a collective process of transition and transformation, and that is absolutely forcing all of that to come to the surface. This is, you know, the true definition of the word apocalypse is to split open and reveal, you know. I do not ascribe to, you know, the Armageddon and the doom and gloom religious mind control of what's in those systems and bodies of work. But I do understand there's a lot of revelation there that tells us, both by etymology of words and otherwise, what we're actually living in. And so with that splitting open and revealing, those psychopaths are being self-revealed.
And is it part of the others having empowering ourselves to be able to expose them and not accept that? And that's part of the empowerment?
Yeah. I mean, that's what's happening with the alternative media and many other components that are not letting go, you know, that are continuing to expose them. Of course, then they have to spin it as fake news and try to demonetize with all things that are going on. And we can get into all that with what our vision is, what we're creating in part two. Again, understanding we have to create a receptacle that cannot be undermined or destroyed as we start transferring everything we've talked about into that. And that's where jurisdiction, private society, status correction, all those kind of things come into play.
And that's all we have for today. There will be a part two, which is going to air on Friday on satellite, and then it'll go onto YouTube and podcasts over the weekend. You can also catch this again at my website, sarahwestall.com. It'll be available later today. And if you want to see any of my past episodes, go there as well. You can also listen to David Williams, which he's on the same path as Ken Cousins here, and he gives you a different, little bit different perspective. But I also want to tell you that if you like these shows, please consider supporting me on Patreon. You can find me under patreon.com/SarahWestall. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.